meeting is
turnout.
Now being recorded.
Thank you. So now that we're on the record and going, why don't we have a very, very full agenda and lots of interesting discussions. So we'll jump right into it if there's no objections. The first item of our agenda is a talk from Raphael, who's one of our members who's been posting to the list on some of these issues. Why don't we, Raphael, if you're ready to go, why don't we start with a brief, some brief remarks from you, and then we'll hopefully foster a bit of discussion on the issues that you raised. Does that sound good?
Thanks, Michael. Can everyone hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. So thank you for giving me the floor and letting me go first. I'm glad to be starting this meeting. So indeed, I published a piece recently on Circle ID. It was, I think, put on the list. So before getting maybe into the more ICANN-related things, there's a few things that I would like to say about law, maybe a bit more in general and applicable law, which I've always guided my reflection on these things and which I think are important to keep in mind. And I think the first one is that law is something that I see and that I think other people see as well as something that regulates or that aims to regulate people's behaviors. And especially when we talk about anything that is online, I think this is very, very good to keep in mind. And so law does not regulate places and it does not regulate things. It may regulate what we do as persons within these places or with these things, but law does not, let's say, target directly or does not regulate directly things or places. It's always about persons, about people first. And so when we think about cyberspace, for example, we're often tempted to talk about, you know, the law of cyberspace, but in the end, it would be more accurate to say that it's the law for people who are on cyberspace, and then we get into the whole discussion about, for example, attribution, about who is behind their computer, since anyone who is, or I don't remember how the cartoon went, but like something like on the internet, everyone is a dog or something like this. So, so that's territory or space can be additional criterion that will help us know who is being targeted by a norm. But it's, so that's the first thing. So when we talk about applicable law then, and maybe more specifically about human rights, so whose behavior are we trying to regulate with human rights? Well, first and foremost, it's states. And I think that's something that I suppose everyone here is rather familiar with since we're in a working group about human rights. So this is what we call sometimes the verticality of human rights, or the fact that human rights norms or the most general ones and the most high-level ones are really targeted at states. So they often come from treaties, for example, when we talk about international law, but they can come from more domestic law, from constitutions and other bills of rights and so on. So these human rights norms are vertical and they aim to regulate the behavior of states. So traditionally speaking, human rights do not, like for example, individual to individual in their relations are not bound by human rights. This may sound a bit strange, but I remember when in France, for example, 2 years ago, they redid the whole contract law, and there were some scholars who said that they should include provisions that contract law should take into account human rights, so meaning that in a contract from one individual to another, such a contract should not violate human rights, and this created a big debate that was not that did not reach very big proportions, but that was still interesting to think about. So that's the more traditional understanding of human rights, let's say. And then another one last thing that would be good to talk about before we get into the real ICANN thing is the extraterritoriality. So if we keep in mind what we have been saying about regulation of the behavior of persons and what applicable law is about human rights, so when we talk about extraterritoriality, then it means that we're talking about laws that regulate the behavior of persons, or maybe that can grant some entitlements to persons when we talk about rights, irrespective of where the behavior would take place. So most of the laws, because they come from states, right, then states are territorial entities, and so some laws are territorially bound, but it's not the case of all of them. And so obviously in the GDPR debate, and even more so when we consider, let's say, transatlantic relations between Europe and North America, and especially between Europe and the U.S., there's been a lot of discussion of the extraterritoriality of the GDPR and whether that was good or bad. So this is not, again, the point. It was not the point of what I wrote on Circle ID either to discuss whether this is something good or bad, but it's more to say that because we have this idea of territory which is really ingrained in our minds, then it can be quite surprising or unexpected, or maybe some people would feel it's wrong as well, to have laws apply beyond certain territories, meaning that laws that would regulate behavior irrespective of where the behavior takes place. But as I said in the article, and I received some comments as well about this, it's not really new. There are certain fields of law where extraterritoriality has been the norm, for example, for quite a long time. So tax law is a good example, especially when we consider U.S. tax law, but it's true of other tax laws as well. And even before that, we can go very, very far back if we want to think about this sphere of law, which is personal status. For example, when as an individual, your personal status, for when we talk about that, it's marriage, divorce, child custody, and these kind of questions have been traditionally regulated by your citizenship irrespective of where you were. So that's also another type of norm which can be seen as extraterritorial. So that being said, now when we talk of ICANN and human rights, so what do we get out of this reflection when we consider rights at ICANN?
Jonathan Metkowski.
So the first thing, and maybe that would be a very narrow reading, and I don't think it's necessarily very wrong. It depends how we take it, but I think it's too narrow, obviously. It would be to say that because ICANN is not a state, then ICANN does not care about human rights. Now, obviously, I don't think that's a vision that is shared by a lot of people in this group, but I think it's an understanding that exists, maybe even in the ICANN community, but certainly outside of it as well. And I think it's wrong to see it this way, not just because there's a human rights bylaw at ICANN, but even beyond that, but it's a bit too narrow. But yeah, it's good to keep in mind that some people may have this vision when we work as well, not to kind of get caught in our understanding of human rights, which is probably more broad than the understanding of human rights that a lot of people have. So now getting to the bylaw itself, not to take too much time, so I'm not going to read the whole bylaw and the interpretation. I think most people here are familiar with it, but obviously the core aspect of it when we talk about applicable law and human rights is when the bylaw states, the human rights bylaw states that subject to delimitations, et cetera, respecting internationally recognized human rights as required by applicable law. And so I think there was some debate about applicable law. Now this debate we can say, or some people want it to be over, and I understand it. I don't think it's necessarily over. I think it's always going to come back, the same way that the question of where ICANN is based is always going to creep in any form of debate that has to do with applicable law, jurisdiction, and so on. But what is interesting to note is that when we think about applicable law, obviously we can say, well, you know, that's the applicable law would be things that, you know, would target ICANN directly, human rights norms that would target ICANN directly. So let's say if governments were to modify human rights norm and say that human rights or that businesses are bound by certain human rights norms in their behavior. So that's one way, and it could happen maybe one day, but right now it's not really so common. What I think is more common is that ICANN, through its operations, through its activities, can interfere in a more indirect way into the fulfillment of the government's human rights duties. So governments must do things in order to protect human rights, and by doing these things, they can, let's say, come into a conflict with how ICANN does things. So ICANN is not necessarily violating, per se, directly human rights provisions that in their most standard form apply only to states, but they can inhibit, prevent, or let's say interfere with the state's own commitments. And I think that the GDPR obviously is a very good example of that. So the GDPR is based on treaty, let's say public international law, human rights norms at the very core of it. Now it has evolved a lot, obviously, beyond the broad provisions that you find in treaties into something very, very concrete that is assorted with fines and so on. And that's what some people would call the more horizontal human rights law, meaning that it's based on human rights, but it aims to regulate the behavior of persons or business entities and give certain entitlements to individuals, for example, against business entities and not only against the state. So that's for the GDPR, but I think there's another, we can try to broaden, and I think that's also the point of my colleague.
Hello?
Yes?
Sorry, I have to cut you off because we have a packed agenda and just strictly 10 minutes. Do you want to just wrap up in 10 or 15
sure.
seconds?
Just one final sentence maybe that would just be that I think related to what Colin sent to the list a few days ago, for example, the rights of indigenous people, I think that it's possible to imagine more horizontal human rights legislation in that field as well that would impact or where ICANN could interfere too. That's all for me. Thank you. Sorry for going
over. Okay, great. Thanks so much for that. No problem. So there's also a link in the chat to Raphael's article. We were hoping to have a little bit of Q&A, but I think the best thing to do might be to just push that forward into the discussion, since I think some of the points that you raise kind of lead naturally into this discussion of how to incorporate human rights due diligence into ICANN's decision-making processes. So if there's nothing super pressing, we can push on to the second part of our agenda, which is which I'll pass over to my co-chair to lead.
Great, thanks a lot, Michael. I'm actually coming to introduce another Michael who has quite a lot of experience in the field of business and human rights. He is joining us today as an ICANN novice. So if moving forward, just a little bit when we go into our discussion, if we could kind of spell acronyms and things like that, that would be great. So I'm here to present Michael Samway. He is the president of the BHR Group, and he has lots of experience, like I said, with different platforms predominantly. Michael, can you hear us? Are you there?
Yes. Thank you, Colin, for inviting me in the introduction and for introducing me, rightly so, as a novice to this field. And I also heard Jonathan join just a moment ago, and Jonathan's a former colleague of many years at Yahoo, so good to hear your voice again, Jonathan.
Likewise, Michael. This is my first call, actually, for human rights. Serendipity has it that we're meeting on the call.
Good. So, Colin, if it's okay, I'm happy to dive in to a bit of background on due diligence as I've worked in this field.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Good. Well, by way of background, I spend about half of my professional time these days teaching, writing, and kind of working on academic things related to technology and human rights, and then the other half working with technology companies on free expression and privacy-related issues, mostly working with them to build the infrastructure of responsible decision-making on human rights issues. My area is much more focused, or has been much more focused, on the platform, but I'm happy to speak to this group about my experience with platforms, working with them, observing them, and I'm sure I will learn a whole lot from all of you. I thought I would structure it as kind of four basic questions, being mindful of the time. The first question is, where does the term and concept of due diligence come from and what it means generally? And the second is, what does it mean in the business and human rights context as applied in the ICT sector? Third question is, what is an effective due diligence methodology in the tech sector, and then kind of wrapping up with the question of how might a company structure a human rights impact assessment, which I'm going to use somewhat interchangeably with the term due diligence, and I'll explain why. So the first question, kind of where does the term and concept of due diligence come from? And it's great we led off with Raphael's discussion on the law, because that's not surprisingly where this term of art does come from. And as a general matter, it comes from the U.S. Securities Act of 1933, which does not mention anywhere in the Act the words due diligence, but through two of its sections does refer to what's typically known as kind of reasonable care or reasonable investigation language, and that's in Section 11 and 12. For the lawyer among you, there are hundreds probably or more law review articles and scores of books, I'm sure, lots of litigation, case law, jurisprudence on the idea of corporate due diligence and kind of the legal roles and responsibilities around the sale of equity in companies, acquisitions, business transactions. But I'll leave that to all of you to go back and look up if it interests you. And what I thought we could cover is kind of the practical application of the concept of due diligence. And I'd like to kind of just call it homework, doing your homework on the risks that you may face as a company, and kind of discuss this in the context of the ICT sector. I teach a seminar at Georgetown on business, human rights, and technology, and we, of course, spend a number of multiple-hour class sessions on the history of the business and human rights movement, but I will push through all that all the way to 2011 and note something that I think all of you are familiar with, and that is the UN Human Rights Council's unanimous endorsement of the kind of what are commonly known as the RUGI principles, the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, and the Protect, Respect, Remedy framework developed by John and his team. And I think we know from Article 19's outstanding work, and more generally, as you all are experts in this field, know that the UN Guiding Principles Working Group on Business and Human Rights for 2018 is focusing on emerging practices and innovation in the field of corporate due diligence, which I assume is why we're having this call, and again, I'm kind of honored to join it. So second big question, what does due diligence mean in the business and human rights context as applied to the ICT sector? And I'll use that term broadly to include platforms, telecommunications companies, network equipment providers, kind of the infrastructure layer of the internet and beyond. And since there's a significant amount of convergence, you can imagine this kind of applying to any company in the technology sector, I think, or I'll try to make it generic enough so I think that it may. To begin kind of the second question on what due diligence means in this context, I would encourage you all to look to the Global Network Initiative Principles on Free Expression and Privacy, and also at what are called the implementation guidelines. And apologies if this is all quite familiar to you. I'm a novice, so that means I'm not exactly sure the background of everybody on the call, but if you go to globalnetworkinitiative.org, you will see a fair amount of material about this multi-stakeholder organization. And in a nutshell, it contains standards, guidance, a platform for learning and advocacy, and then a mechanism to evaluate company policy and practice against the standards. And this all makes, at least in my mind, the GNI the most impactful multi-stakeholder organization really in the world for working with companies and holding them accountable in respecting freedom of expression and privacy. It currently has, I think, about somewhere between 12 and 14 or 15 company members, probably two or three dozen civil society members, close to a dozen social responsible investors, more than a dozen academics, and also has independent participants who are technologists and advocates in the field. And I note the GNI because due diligence is a central feature of the GNI. And I, again, would encourage participants on the call, and whether civil society, academics, or company participants, to consider learning more about the GNI and even consider joining as observers or as full members. I want to read one short section, if I can pull it up here, from the GNI implementation guidelines, which is the guidance given to companies on how to meet the principles themselves. So the first sentence of, as it happens, is section 2 of the implementation guidelines reads, consistent with the UN guiding principles on business and human rights and considering international human rights standards, participating companies will carry out human rights due diligence to identify, prevent, evaluate, mitigate, and account for risks to the freedom of expression and privacy rights that are implicated by the company's products, services, activities, and operations. So any corporate member, and just by way of example, Yahoo, Google, Microsoft were the founding corporate members, but it now includes Facebook, Nokia, Orange, a group of European telcos, formerly included LinkedIn before its acquisition by Microsoft, and is, I think, just welcomed British Telecom also to full membership. So let me turn to the third question, and that is, if there's a due diligence requirement in GNI or as an international norm under the UN guiding principles, what's an effective methodology to conduct your due diligence, your homework? And again, this will kind of be a quick discussion, and I'm using the terms due diligence and human rights impact assessment somewhat interchangeably. Conducting a human rights impact assessment is a form of due diligence, and you would kind of be doing your due diligence in part if you conducted one. So again, for purposes of the short call, I will use them somewhat interchangeably. And on methodology, I'll give you some sense of some of the advice, just by way of example, that I might give to a company on how to conduct a human rights impact assessment. The first question to ask is, when should the company conduct a human rights impact assessment? And there's a long list, but some rather obvious examples might be launching operations in a new market, divesting from a market, entering into a commercial relationship, whether it's a partnership, a joint venture, acquiring another company, launching a new product, something that happens often in the technology sector, or changing the functionality of an existing product. And just to give one example, if a company that offers a communications product is planning to enable encryption by default or disable encryption by default, let's say it's an existing product, there should be a human rights analysis of the impacts of that product change or modification. And in terms of methodology, a company should also identify the internal cross-functional team, and cross-functional is an overused term in Silicon Valley, but the idea is that it should not just be a group of lawyers or a group of policy team members. It should include technical team members, the engineering team, the security team, product sales, corporate development, business development, local team members who are, if it's a kind of a new market, or on the ground. Another key aspect from the methodology standpoint is to identify not only the internal stakeholders, but external stakeholders in anticipation of consultation with those stakeholders. And this is a practice that would, if we were talking about the supply chain or extractive industries, I think we would be going through the same type of external stakeholders. So consumers, civil society, local government, your host government, if you're an American company or any other company. And you would identify those stakeholders and begin the outreach and consultation process. As a methodological point, I encourage companies to conduct these type engagements under the Chatham House rule, and that often provides a safer space for discussion. Because there are risks both to employees and to local stakeholders, at times for, based on either the subject of the conversation or the conversation itself. I also encourage companies to develop questionnaire and kind of a consultation guide that is focused on the intersection point of the business and human rights issue. And then kind of a, just a final example, the company should facilitate the discussion both in their home market, but if this is, let's say, a launch of a product or an entire operation, new market in that local market. So the last question, how to structure a human rights impact assessment. And I'll be brief here and just ask you to imagine that you are drafting a report for these purposes about entering a new market. You're a technology company, you're going to enter a new market, and you want to think about the type report, and of course it's going to be much more work than just this report, but think about it, think about the rigor that comes with writing a report, presenting a report, perhaps asking the executive team to sign off, to literally sign off and sign that they have read and approved a report and understand the attendant risks and the mitigation strategies. So this is what a report might look like. As one example, it might begin with a description of international human rights laws and norms, kind of the role of business in society, and language that will be familiar to all of you, the UDHR, its implementing treaties, the UN guiding principles. I mentioned the GNI principles. The following section might be the general political and human rights landscape in the identified market. And again, I'm just using as an example the launch of a business in a new market. So there should be kind of history and current state of the market. What is the view and the perspective of civil society? What have they written? What have they said? What have academics said? Press, think tanks, you know, what if it's an American company, the State Department human rights reports, what have they written about this market? The following section might be the kind of more traditional homework that a company would do. What is the legal and regulatory environment? That's, of course, important from a business perspective, but also critical if you're a technology company and interested, as you should be, in human rights. What is the landscape from a regulatory perspective around free expression and privacy? Is there a network architecture of censorship? Are there pledges required of local companies to censor content? Is there broad bulk surveillance? What does the local regulatory environment say about, you know, individual data requests? Are you required to give up your encryption keys if you use encrypted products? And the next section of the human rights impact assessment might be a clear description of what company's product and business strategy is in the market. So you would be setting this out and everything from what the local corporate structure would be to what where data will be stored to will you have employees on the ground, local employees, and so on. And then kind of these, and I'll finish with these last three sections. And this is really the heart of the human rights impact assessment and of your due diligence if you're a company. The first is what are the digital rights intersection points? And this is kind of risk identification. So if we think about the technology sector, we think probably first about free expression and privacy. And these are the big questions, not just about the market generally and what is the environment, but what are the intersection points with the company's products, services, operations, and the rights to free expression and privacy. So everything from censorship risks, are companies asked to censor, to throttle, to shut down services from a privacy perspective? You know, how does surveillance work? Is it at the request of a wide group of government officials and agencies? Is it narrowly tailored in the law? What type of request, what sort of not only the regulatory framework, but the actual practice? And that would be the identification of risk points. I often encourage companies to also, and this would be the kind of second to last section, to consider the opportunities that the service may have to promote human rights. And this may be in the sort of ICCPR context. It may be in the International Covenant Economic, Social, Cultural Rights context. But what are the kind of the social goods and impacts and economic and cultural rights that may be positively impacted by the company? And then the final session of the human rights impact assessment, and again, this I consider to be sort of the heart of it, these last three sections, is what is the risk mitigation strategy that the company has adopted and plans to adopt and send to the senior executives to sign off on? And this, of course, is going to be detailed based on the specific case, and I'm just giving a kind of a generic example. So some generic recommendations that probably would show up in any risk mitigation strategy and recommendation that a company is doing based on its due diligence would be including establishing and publicly stating the company's principles regarding human rights or its endorsement of certain principles. And I always recommend the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a very good starting place and working from there. The company should establish a team that is, as I mentioned before, cross-functional, but also that has capacity, that is not just a team in name, but that has people assigned to it, that has budget, that has internal accountability, and is built so that it's sustainable. Another generic recommendation might be to build sustainable process inside the company to deal with human rights issues. So the escalation paths if human rights issues come up, that the human rights team is involved in strategic business decision-making, that a company crafts and regularly revises its policies on whether it's content, law enforcement response, that it trains the internal stakeholders and the employees who work in this field on a regular basis, that it makes stakeholder engagement a core part of any of its human rights decision making. And we're, of course, focused on the ICT sector. And then I will kind of close on this kind of risk mitigation strategy section by noting that it's critical that companies create an accountability framework internally and externally. And this is some way to evaluate its own work. And there are internal mechanisms, and this is, would be familiar to people in the kind of financial accounting world, and it's a newer field in terms of sort of social assessment. And I look at the GNI really as kind of the gold standard in the technology sector of external assessment. So there is at the end of every other year, an external kind of independent expert assessment or audit of the participating companies. And there's an evaluation that's conducted. The board reviews that and makes a recommendation. And then those are published at the end of when GNI publishes its annual report. So I will close by saying these are all steps, I think, towards a responsible company decision-making. They are based on the concept of due diligence. I have written a few book chapters and articles for any who are interested. I'm happy to share those with Colin to distribute further. So thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for joining us. Actually, we're going right into our next session, but in between, I have a couple questions that I wanted to share. So I might kind of begin segueing into our next session, just by saying that Article 19 has been working over the past year or two to try to develop new impact assessment models for internet infrastructure providers, so companies. And I think that some of the challenges that we have faced in trying to do this really speak to the challenges that the ICANN community faces in trying to develop similar impact assessment models. And one of those is when we're talking about external stakeholder engagement, for example, or trying to consult with potential affected stakeholders as a part of both impact assessment and potential risk mitigation, it's not as clear cut as entering a new market or developing a product sometimes, because you might be developing a new policy that will be applicable to all registries and registrars around the world, which would effectively impact, you know, the majority of internet users. I wonder if you have encountered any similar kinds of problems of scale in your previous work, and if you had any kind of tips on how to address it.
Thank you, Colin, for the question. I think this is one of the challenges, if I can return to the GNI, and I mentioned briefly at the beginning, of not only convergence, but the need to encompass the kind of the wider array of companies that have grown and the wider array of kind of vexing problems that have grown with them. Take us back to 2005 at the beginning of the discussion of the creation of a code of conduct for the sector. I think we began as a few different groups, in November, December 2005. The world seemed much simpler, and it was, to us anyway, it was internet companies, telecommunication companies, and hardware providers. Clearly, it's significantly more complex. So I think without answering your question, I'll just note that I agree that this is one of the great challenges we have now, and it's terrific to see Article 19 diving into an area that is less public-facing, the infrastructure level. Certainly, as you think about advocacy strategies, it's much easier, as difficult as it is, to build an advocacy campaign around public and consumer-facing challenge and organization than it is kind of at the infrastructure level where consumers, just using kind of a piece of network equipment, may have that equipment in their home. It may be ubiquitous or in their business or use it one way or another through their mobile phone connection, but because it doesn't seem to touch them in a public way, in a way that they're familiar with. It's much more difficult to push for human rights in that context. So I admire your work in that area. I'm not sure what the answer is to, but you and I discussed this, I know, in Toronto at RightsCon, and I think the work you're doing is going to help make it easier to build successful advocacy campaigns in that area.
Great, thanks. Well, I wanted to make sure that there wasn't any, you know, new developments or new tools that I was unaware of. And really tying it back to the ICANN community, I think that this is beyond the work that Article 19 is doing, which we can dive into momentarily. I think this is a really great opportunity for the ICANN community and the multi-stakeholder model to kind of produce these kinds of due diligence mechanisms and tools that can scale to the extent of the global internet. So maybe we can just put on the record that this is a gap that needs filling, and potentially either the CCWP or members of the ICANN community will be able to help contribute to this. Okay, thanks. Yeah, let's just dive right into the next part of our agenda, which is we are going to give another practical example of some work that's been done in the ICANN community. This is a recent partnership that Article 19, which is, for those of you who aren't aware, it is a UK a London-based freedom of expression organization, and we've been active in ICANN, the IETF, and other related standard development organizations for the past 4 years. So we kicked off a project late last year to begin developing human rights impact assessment models, as I said, for internet industry actors. And we actually put out a report, which I've just pasted into the chat, earlier this year, that's about specifically about the UNGP, the adoption of the United Nations Guiding Principles in the internet infrastructure industry. So if you want to have a look at that, you can see that it echoes quite a lot of the issues that Michael was addressing, and as well as the practical steps that can be taken to move forward. So And here we've got Michele Melon joining us from Black Knight, which is based in, it's a registrar and hosting provider based in Ireland. And we're going to speak a little bit to a very recent partnership just a couple weeks ago in an ongoing project to develop these kinds of self-assessment models to kick off this discussion of due diligence within registries, registrars, and other similar actors. So I wondered if I could turn to Michele first, and if you could speak a little bit to potentially your incentives for becoming involved in this project.
Thanks, Colin. Good afternoon, everybody. Michele here. So I think part of our thing is that we, as a company, have always been strongly in favor of operating in a transparent fashion. And as a result of that, one of the things that we had been exploring for some time but hadn't really taken any action on was looking at prudentially producing transparency reports. And then when we learned of the Article 19 projects with looking at infrastructure providers and that entire thing, we thought it might be interesting to get involved there, so we did. So I suppose in terms of like, well, our incentive would be, I think it's partly around positioning in the market. I mean, ultimately, as a hosting provider and domain name registrar, a lot of what we offer and sell is the same as what plenty of other companies offer and sell. So the kind of differentiator we would take is in the way we approach both the business, the industry, our clients, all that. Not sure much more I can really say on that. Colin?
No, that's fine. Yeah, thanks. So thanks for sharing that. So what the kind of practical bit of the impact assessment looked like was it was in the form of an interview and trying to tease out what would be the salient rights, because this is an ongoing process to develop new tools. So this was equal parts revising the self-assessment tool, which we eventually hope will be ready for deployment for different infrastructure providers, as well as kind of teasing out the different kinds of services or due diligence processes that may or may not be in place in companies like registries and registrars. So what I can say about what we found from our collaboration was we succeeded in identifying the most salient rights for operations as privacy, freedom of expression, and security. And that was looking at everything from relationships with ICANN to relationships with third parties or governments. I actually posted a link in the chat to an overview of the project where you can find an earlier version of the assessment tool and a link at the bottom if you wanted to have a look. And then really kind of digging into the due diligence element of this self-assessment, which is looking at assessing impacts, responding to impacts, government requests, transparency, as Michele said, and access to remedy. Now, these are all elements that we would like to see incorporated into the ICANN community and ICANN decision-making processes. Kind of harkening back to the bylaw, as Rafael mentioned, we've already succeeded in achieving this high-level policy commitment to respect human rights. So trying to figure out how it percolates down is the next big challenge. So what we found with Black Knight, after identifying the salient rights, we found that while human rights commitments might not explicitly factor into things like agreements with ICANN or agreements with registries or even internal processes, there were quite a lot of things like on a more granular level, like staff trainings on privacy and security, that would definitely count towards human rights due diligence, even if it's not referred to directly as such. So this was one really positive note, that sometimes there's this kind of gulf in seeing that, oh, human rights due diligence, it's something so big, so hard, how do you eat an elephant? And this is kind of the answer bit by bit. If you start off with small staff trainings or publishing transparency reports on government or third-party requests, that kind of brings you two steps down the path of leading towards due diligence best practices. So I wonder, Michele, following the impact assessment and the kind of the work that we've done together, did you have any do you have any takeaways from the process or any planned next steps?
Thanks, Colin. I suppose the thing is this, I mean, as you kind of alluded to, there were certain things that we might have been looking at, but not explicitly, that would kind of fit into that, into this kind of human rights concern box, or whatever you want to call it. And then, you know, one of the other things I think that we definitely discovered while I was going through it is, you know, there are certain areas where it would be quite easy for us to make a simple change, just to simply ask suppliers, you know, have they made any commitments in this area? And even just asking the question is already more than what we're doing at present, so that would be, that wouldn't be particularly hard to do. I mean, there are other things I think that might work well for a larger company, but for a company such as ourselves would just not be viable. I think there was a number of things where the standard questions were, like, you know, about going to third parties for all sorts of kind of assessments and everything else, which would just wouldn't work for a company of our size. So I think, you know, just from even kind of going through some of the questions with the two of you, I think that was quite helpful and enlightening. I mean, also as well, the presentation you gave to our staff earlier in the day, so just for the rest of you on the call, basically they were here for essentially a full day. And they started off by giving our staff a presentation about trying to explain what exactly they're talking about when they talk about human rights, and giving it a bit of context for businesses and how businesses could deal with it and why that might be important, et cetera, et cetera. That, I think, was quite interesting and helpful. And overall, I think, you know, we obviously had done a certain amount of work in advance. I mean, we'd given you a lot of our internal company policies and contracts and things like that. And then we got, you know, going through some of the questions. I suppose the real kind of challenge was kind of teasing it out and trying to take a very generic set of questions and then be able to apply them to something that we could relate to. Can be a bit of a challenge, which is quite time consuming. But I think overall it was an interesting exercise, and I look forward to reading the full report.
Great, thanks. We had a question from Rafiq in the chat where he said, I'm not sure what we mean by ICANN decision-making processes here. So what I was referring to there were not only the policy development processes, but also the decision-making processes behind advisory committee's recommendations. And, you know, basically the decision-making processes in each supporting organization and advisory committee to kind of come together to steer the ICANN community ship and to determine what kind of, you know, policies and operations come out of it.
So should we only have about 10 minutes left in the call. Should we try to transition into part four now maybe, and try to bring all three of these discussions back to the ICANN process and the challenge that we have ahead of us. How can we, the main community question that we had spelled out for this discussion is, how can we integrate systematic procedures for due diligence into ICANN's decision-making process? But, you know, a real challenge as we look about operationalizing of the human rights bylaw is how do we actually see this playing out? How does the human rights bylaw and the idea of human rights effective assessments apply to working groups, to SOACs? How do we apply this to consultation, and who are we reaching out to, and when? Which is a really interesting thing that I think was brought up by previous speakers. When are we looking at human rights considerations coming into play? So with that, building on the previous discussions that we've heard, why don't we open it up to questions and discussion on how we connect this back to human rights at ICANN.
Yeah.
And I see a hand from David McCauley. David, please go ahead.
Thanks, Michael. David McCauley speaking for the record. And just for context, I should mention I'm employed by a registry, VeriSign, which runs the .com registry, among others. And 2 points. One is to your most recent question, Michael, an appropriate question, when does this take place? I should note that there are some important policy development processes underway, including one where I have a call starting in 10 minutes on rights protection mechanisms for people with interest in GTLDs, generic top-level domains. And the other is in this policy development process underway that I'm participating in WorkTrack 5 of that deals with subsequent procedures. And so there are things underway that might bear consideration in this respect. I have a general comment on the topic, and that is, as a participant in WorkStream 2 on the human rights sub-team, I would just note one caution. I know that Rafael mentioned he thought that the human rights bylaw was somewhat narrow and that the phrasing is somewhat important, internationally recognized human rights as required by applicable law. That's language that in both WorkStream 1 and WorkStream 2 we labored over long and hard. And the framework of interpretation that will soon be presented to the board for adoption, framework of interpretation of the human rights bylaw, is narrow given ICANN's unique role as coordinator of the domain name system. It's not really at the technical level where the IETF is. It's not the content layer where so many companies are. So I'll illustrate this, and I'm almost done. I'll illustrate this with the Ruby principles. We spoke long about that. The Ruby principles have a concept within them that if you have leverage to get your business partners, correspondents, whatever, to adopt human rights principles, you should use it. Well, ICANN has plenty of leverage over registries, registrars, registrants, and others. And yet, ICANN, that could pull ICANN at the content level where it really has no business. And so I would just urge some caution in getting involved in PDPs or whatever to make sure that the bylaw is followed as written and the framework of interpretation, which I expect will be adopted, is understood. And so I appreciate, I think everything that's been said, I really appreciate the comments that have been said and understand this. But my point is that ICANN has a unique role, and hopefully that role will be taken into account when people launch into human rights endeavors so that they're appropriately tailored to ICANN's context. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that. I think it's a very good point. Do we have any other interventions based on the topics or questions for the previous speakers? McKaylee.
Yeah, thanks, McKaylee, again. I think I definitely had a conversation with Colin and her colleague about this when they were here. I think part of the issue is with when we're talking about human rights in this context, and again, it's something which came out very clearly in the presentation that they gave to my staff, is that the terminology human rights appears very kind of big and scary, and it makes us all think about a lot of different things, but not really what this is about a lot of the time. So I think in some respects, the terminology itself is a problem. I mean, if you need to kind of expand it out so people understand it's things like freedom of expression, privacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But when you sort of say human rights, that kind of it does seem to make people think about things that are probably out of scope for what most of us would be dealing with, which is partly, I think, part of the reason why there was a lot of pushback around conversations involving human rights within ICANN when it was first mooted a couple of years back. Thanks.
I see Colin's hand up, so why don't you just jump right in?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and thanks for bringing that up, McKaylee. And teasing out human rights is one thing that we've been trying to do as part of the CCWP for a long time. It's work that actually predates my involvement in the CCWP. The steps of identifying salient human rights is part of due diligence, part of human rights impact assessments. You kind of have to tease out the rights that will be affected before you can zero in on the actual impact. So let's see. I just wanted to share in the chat this HRAA model. It was very early prototype. I intend for it to evolve as the human rights bylaw is hopefully adopted soon, and this kind of policy commitment begins to work its way through the community. I just wanted to draw your attention to this model, and in it, what we tried to do was, tease out the different rights, privacy, freedom of expression, freedom of association, and this would be more of an impact assessment rather than a gap analysis. When you're looking at companies, oftentimes you'll be saying, do you have a policy about X? Do you have, a procedure for Y? And I see that as being more gap analysis, whereas this is really trying to say, what is the negative impact scenario? How many people could be affected? What is the severity of the impact? What are the vulnerable groups, et cetera? So I would encourage people, participants on the call, to have a look at this model and maybe share thoughts on how it could be adopted or evolved. Thanks.
So we are closing in on the top of the hour. I think we might have time for one more intervention if anybody wants to jump in.
Michael, this is Michael Samway. Just quickly responding to a few points. Michaela mentioned transparency. I did mention this, but this is, I think, an essential part of accountability, and I'd encourage companies and ICANN itself to be as transparent as possible with all its stakeholders. Two other quick things Michaela mentioned, and that is that this type of due diligence can be expensive, and I think there are ways that small companies, and this is one of the emerging fields with small private companies you think of in the U.S., ways companies can focus on human rights without it requiring a dozen public policy team members on board before you begin that type work. He also mentioned that it's important that human rights is something that you give kind of more context and not just say human rights. And I think it gets to a point that David made, which is it's important to define the scope and find the intersection point of either the company or the organization's work so that you can be effective in the work you're doing to limit human rights risk. And one of the concepts that's used in the Global Network Initiative is that companies, at least in that context, should use pressure to encourage their partners, I'm just going to use this in the partner context, to also uphold the principles of free expression and privacy in a way that's commensurate with the leverage that they have. And I know this is can be complicated with ICANN itself. But the two points I think that David made are very good ones, which is to find the scope, find the intersection points, and Colin mentioned the most salient ones relevant to either your business, your organization, if it's ICANN, and then use the pressure that's commensurate with the leverage that you have. So thank you again for inviting me. I learned a ton on the call.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much to you and to all of our presenters and to everybody for joining us. We are at the top of the hour. I think this was a really, really interesting conversation. There's a ton of food for thought and a lot of interesting perspectives shared, very, very relevant to us going forward, I think. We'll quickly open it up unless anybody has anything to add. I guess we'll close off.
This is Jonathan McKelsey. I just wanted to know if I can get on the agenda for 1 minute.
Yeah, certainly.
Thanks so much. So I enjoyed listening to the call. As you may know, I'm new to the group. I recently applied individually to join the NCUC, and as you know, Risk IQ is a member of the intellectual property constituency, and I'm its representative. My motive in wanting to join NCUC is simply because I don't see, I think that, the commercial interest in intellectual property and primarily cybersecurity for our company, but there is no constituency in ICANN for cybersecurity, as you probably know. That can be consistent with, you know, protecting and recognizing human rights. And so I want to learn more about that, and, you know, and I see those things as potentially consistent. And, you know, I wanted to know if there's a process whereby my individual membership becomes accepted because my application is pending, or if anyone has any concerns in that regard. Thanks.
That is a bigger question than I can deal with when we're already over time. But the questions about NCUC membership and NCSG membership, which is what it fundamentally comes down to, should be directed to that list and to the executive there. So that will be an interesting question to follow up on in those fora. And anybody that has any additional with regards to human rights would be very, very welcome to share it with the list. So thanks, everybody. Sorry to keep you a couple minutes over time. But
one follow-up question.
I have a follow-up question.
Human rights? Isn't this within NCUC, or maybe I'm just misunderstanding? Thanks.
So actually, this is kind of a strange bird. We are a cross-community forum for discussions related to human rights, but we are chartered within the NCSG. So this is kind of stemming from the kind of Workstream 1 and Workstream 2 work that introduced human rights into the ICANN environment. So while we cannot speak to NCSG or NCUC membership, those questions should actually be referred to the NCSG or NCUC leaders.
Okay.
You as a member of the ICANN community are absolutely more than welcome to join the conversation within this forum.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. Thanks so much.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
Yes, absolutely. We welcome you.
Wrap it up. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining our call today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.